Listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Dave Payne, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 6th and 7th 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our first article today will be entitled Netflix Sets Deal for Warner Brothers Acquisition by Streaming Giant will cost $72 billion. But it faces antitrust concerns. Articles written by Joe Flint and Lauren Thomas. Netflix has agreed to buy Warner Brothers for $72 billion after the entertainment company splits its studios and HBO Max streaming business from its cable networks, a deal that would reshape the entertainment and media industry. The cash and stock transaction was announced Friday after the two sides entered into exclusive negotiations for the media company known for Superman and the Harry Potter movies, as well as hit TV shows such as Friends. The offer is valued at $27.75 per Warner Brothers Discovery share and has an enterprise value of roughly $82.7 billion. Rival Paramount Skydance, which sought to buy the entire company, including Warner's cable networks, bid $30 per share, all cash, for Warner Discovery, according to people familiar with the matter. Paramount is weighing its next move, which could involve pivoting to other potential acquisitions, people familiar with its plan said. Paramount had argued that a deal with Netflix wouldn't be blessed by antitrust regulators, given it would further cement the streamer's global dominance. President Trump's advisors, including White House officials, are concerned about the deal, a senior administration official said Friday. Netflix's deal will have to contend with the preferences of Trump, who is close with Paramount chief executive David Ellison and his father, and could pressure antitrust enforcers to steer Warner toward Paramount instead. Netflix co-chief executive Ted Sarandos said the company is highly confident about approval because it is pro-consumer and pro-innovation. Netflix's deal with Warner would combine the largest global streaming service with its smaller rival, as entertainment companies seek ways to add new subscribers and boost revenue with price increases. It gives more heft to Netflix, which has ascended from a DVD-by-mail rental business into a powerful force in Hollywood. Netflix shares dropped nearly 3% Friday, while Warner shares rose over 6%. Paramount shares dropped almost 10%, suggesting its shareholders had expected the company to land the deal, which would have helped it compete with larger rivals. Netflix's Sarandos said on an investor call that while over the years Netflix had typically been builders, not buyers, the opportunity to purchase Warner was a rare opportunity that sets it up for years. We can't stand still, he said. Netflix, the streaming giant home to K-pop Demon Hunters, Love is Blind, and Stranger Things, said the deal would help it attract and retain more subscribers, giving its it Warner's vast TV and movie libraries, as well as HBO and HBO Max shows. It expects the deal to significantly expand U.S. production capacity. HBO and its streaming service, HBO Max, will continue to operate as a standalone, Sarandos said. Netflix co-CEO Greg Peters said the HBO brand is powerful to consumers. That gives us a lot of options to figure out how you package things in different ways, he said. The company, which typically releases films directly to its streaming service, said it expects to continue Warner's business of releasing movies in theaters. The deal, Netflix's largest ever, is one of the biggest transactions announced so far this year as mergers and acquisitions activity has picked up but back up under the Trump administration. Warner Discovery CEO David Zaslav said the combination will ensure people everywhere will continue to enjoy the world's most resonant stories for generations to come. Warner Discovery is continuing with plans to split itself into two separate companies, one comprising the studio and streaming assets, and the other containing its global cable network operations before closing a potential deal with Netflix. Paramount had sought to buy the entire company, including cable networks such as CNN, TNT, and TBS. Though Paramount offered Warner a higher price per share than Netflix did, Warner saw Netflix's deal as superior, given that Warner shareholders would continue to own shares in both companies following its planned split, people familiar with the matter said. By that measure, Warner concluded Netflix's deal values the company at around $31 to $32 per a share versus Paramount's $30, the people said. Warner Discovery and Netflix said they expect the deal to close in 12 to 18 months. A Netflix acquisition of Warner Discovery streaming and studio asset raises questions about how the streaming giant's business model might change in the future, including how it releases films, analysts have said. Theatrical exhibition trade body Cinema United CEO Michael O'Leary said before the deal was announced that such a transaction poses an unprecedented threat to the global exhibition business. Warner's TV studio sells shows to several networks and streaming services, including rivals of both HBO Max and Netflix. Netflix has historically kept its shows in-house. The deal is a blow to Paramount CEO Ellison's ambitions of bringing together two famed entertainment brands. Ellison took control of Paramount earlier this year. Paramount wrote in a Wednesday letter to Zaslav that the company had embarked on a myopic process with a predetermined outcome that favors a single bidder. Paramount earlier criticized Netflix's bid in a letter to Warner Discovery's lawyers, saying a sale to the streamer would likely never close because of potential regulatory challenges here and abroad, given its global dominance. There's an interesting chart just above this article. It shows shares of U.S. TV viewing by distributor. This is from October 2025. And at the top of the chart is YouTube with about 12%. Then Walt Disney's 11%. NBC Universal, 8%, a little over 8%. Fox, a little over 8%. Paramount is at 8%. Netflix is at 8%. Warner Brothers is just about 6%. Amazon's about 4%. And the Roku channel is about 3%. More about the Netflix Warner Brothers deal. There's another article, the Netflix Warner Brothers deal likely to face DOJ scrutiny. This is written by Joe Flint, Dave Michaels, and Lauren Thomas. Netflix beat out Paramount and Comcast to land a $72 billion deal for Warner Brothers Discovery Studios and HBO Max streaming service. Now it has to win over the Trump administration. The streaming giant's deal is expected to be investigated by the Justice Department, which has already begun considering how it would further cement Netflix's dominance in the media industry. It will also have to contend with the preferences of President Trump, who is close with Paramount Chief Executive David Ellison and his father, and could pressure antitrust enforcers to steer Warner toward Paramount instead. A senior administration official said Friday that Trump advisors, including White House officials, are concerned about Netflix's deal. Paramount, meanwhile, had in recent days accused Warner of unfairly favoring Netflix's deal, which it said would be frowned upon by regulators in the U.S. and abroad. Paramount, whose shares slumped Friday after Netflix prevailed, is now weighing its next move, people familiar with the matter said. Netflix, the largest streamer, has said the deal for Warner's vast TV and movie libraries has, as well as HBO and its HBO Max streaming platform, would help it attract and retain more subscribers. Netflix has also said it would keep Warner Brothers and HBO making shows and movies, which is good for the creative community. Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos said Friday the company is highly confident the deal will win approval because it is pro-consumer and pro-innovation. The Justice Department will have to formally investigate to determine whether it should challenge the deal. Merger investigations typically take at least 10 months before the government files suit to block the transaction. More so than in previous administrations, the White House is likely to influence where regulators land, said Sam Weinstein, a professor at the Cardozo School of Law. During Trump's first term, the Justice Department unsuccessfully challenged AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner. More recently, the Trump administration approved Skydance Media's merger with Paramount. Ellison, the son of Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison, a Trump ally, had promised the Federal Communications Commission that CBS News, a unit of Paramount, would deliver unbiased reporting and that Paramount's diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives would end. Trump's current antitrust chiefs, Gail Slater at the Justice Department and Andrew Ferguson at the FTC, have had a relatively light touch so far when it comes to policing big deals. Both have made clear that they are focused on protecting competition in cost of living sectors such as healthcare and housing. Many companies have gotten deals blessed by offering settlements, which typically involve agreeing to sell pieces of the business to a third party. Some inside the Justice Department already believe Netflix's acquiring Warner's HBO Max might violate antitrust laws because of the combined entity's scale among streaming services, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Netflix and HBO Max together would control around 30% of the U.S. subscription streaming marketplace. Mergers of direct competitors are presumed to be illegal when the combined company has more than 30% market share, according to Justice Department guidelines announced in 2023 under former President Joe Biden and retained by the Trump administration. Netflix has argued that the streaming marketplace should also include mostly free video platforms such as YouTube, Facebook, and TikTok. It also believes that even if the market is limited to subscription-based services, there is no evidence that adding HBO Max would reduce competition or harm consumers, according to a person familiar with the matter. Netflix has said HBO and its streaming service HBO Max will continue to operate as standalone entities after the deal closes, but will be both bundled and separately sold alongside Netflix, which could mean lower prices for consumers. In a potential sign of Netflix's confidence, it agreed to pay Warner a so-called breakup fee of $5.8 billion if the deal was scuttled because the companies couldn't obtain necessary approvals. Netflix hired lawyers at Skadden to guide it through the deal. Paramount hired its own legal heavyweight in Macon Abdelrahim, who ran the Justice Department's antitrust division during Trump's first term. Netflix's deal has already drawn scrutiny from lawmakers in both parties. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Democrat from Massachusetts, said Friday the proposed deal is a, quote, anti-monopoly nightmare that will raise consumer costs and limit choice. U.S. Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, earlier wrote on X that the potential deal, quote, would raise serious competition questions, perhaps more so than any transaction I've seen in about a decade, unquote. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, next I'll read through some of the worldwide headlines and some of the associated articles. The first one is the latest annual U.S. strategy document portrays European nations as wayward, declining powers led by governments that suppress democracy and muzzle voices that want a more nationalistic turn. Next is a key vaccine panel at the CDC voted 8-3 to quash a recommendation that all newborns be given a first dose of hepatitis B vaccine. Also, the Supreme Court will decide if Trump can end the practice of granting citizenship to children born in the U.S., setting up a potential landmark showdown over one of the president's signature policy priorities. Another highlight, a federal judge ordered the release of grand jury transcripts from the Justice Department's investigation into Jeffrey Epstein in Florida. And the United Arab Emirates paid more than $20 million to secure the freedom of the Emirati prince kidnapped by Al-Qaeda's West African affiliate, Western officials said. And also, the Eurovision 2026 was stirred up after several European countries said they would boycott the song contest because Israel was allowed to participate despite the war in Gaza. And finally, a worldwide highlight, Frank Gehry, 96. He was a world-renowned architect. He has died. So I will dive into an article. Again, it's about the Supreme Court will decide if Trump can and end the practice of granting citizenship of children born in the U.S., setting up a potential landmark showdown over one of the president's signature policy priorities. Okay, the article is entitled High Court Will Weigh Birthright Citizenship. It's written by Lydia Wheeler. The Supreme Court will decide if President Trump can limit the practice of granting citizenship to all children born in the U.S., setting up a potential landmark showdown over one of the president's signature policy priorities. the justices agreed to hear the Trump administration's appeal of a lower court ruling that found the president's executive order ending birthright citizenship is unconstitutional. It will be the second time the Supreme Court has considered litigation over the birthright citizenship order. In June, the conservative majority limited the power of lower court judges to issue nationwide injunctions after the administration challenged the scope of rulings blocking the president's order. Now the court will weigh a different question, whether Trump can deny citizenship to children born on U.S. soil if neither parent is a U.S. citizen or permanent legal resident. A handful of courts have said Trump's order violates the 14th Amendment, which has long been understood to grant citizenship at birth to all but the children of foreign diplomats and foreign military forces in the U.S. The Trump administration argues that reading is wrong. U.S. Solicitor General John Sauer said the 14th Amendment was adopted to confer citizenship on Black Americans and their children newly freed from slavery, not on the children of illegal immigrants or people temporarily visiting the U.S. Allowing illegal immigrants to obtain the privilege of citizenship for their children through wrongdoing, cutting ahead of those who seek entry and citizenship through lawful means, degrades that gift and dilutes its meaning, he said. The case the justices agreed to hear stems from a class action brought by the parents of two babies born in the U.S. and a pregnant woman who has since given birth. They urged the justices to reject the administration's appeal, saying the court already settled this question in 1898 in a case known as United States versus Wong Kim Ark. The government's case, quote, amounts to little more than a jumble of historical misstatements and apposite citations, newly manufactured doctrines, and more than anything else, policy preference, attorneys for the challengers said in their court filing. Okay, next article is just about the key price gauge rose moderately in September. The Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation held 3% in September and indicated a moderate month-over-month increase in prices unlikely to block consideration of an interest rate cut at the central bank's meeting next week. Consumer prices as measured by the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index rose by 0.3% in September, the Commerce Department said Friday, in a report that was delayed by more than a month by a recent government shutdown that yielded a slight rise in the 12-month PCE inflation rate to 2.8% from 2.7% in August. The core rate, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, declined to 2.8% from 2.9% in August. The month-over-month increase in prices was close in line with Wall Street's forecast, which for PCE inflation tend to be highly accurate because the metric relies on previously published data. The Fed typically would have had a full view on October inflation and November employment heading into its final meeting of the year. But the shutdown has delayed that data, leaving the Fed to weigh its next move with only a dated set of metrics. Okay, next article is entitled Vaccine Panel Nixes Hepatitis B Guidance. This article is written by Liz Esley White and Sabrina Sadikwe. A key vaccine panel at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention voted 8-3 to nix a recommendation that all newborns be given a first dose of hepatitis B vaccine. The Friday vote, which came after the panel heard presentations from vaccine skeptics, does away with guidance that has been in place since 1991. Scientists have credited with helping drive down rates of hepatitis B infection, which can lead to liver damage, cancer, and death. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, recommended that if an infant's mother tests negative for hepatitis B, parents should consult a doctor about whether the baby needs an early vaccine dose. ACIP also suggested that infants who skip the birth dose shouldn't receive their first dose until they're at least 2 months of age. The recommendation from the committee, which was remade by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. earlier this year after he pushed out all the previous members, must be endorsed by the acting CDC director before it goes into effect. Proponents of the change argued that not enough is known about potential risks of the vaccine and that most babies aren't likely to contract the virus. One panel member, Dr. Evelyn Griffin, said the vaccine could lead to autoimmune conditions, while acknowledging no high-quality studies had shown that. Patients are unaware that their babies are getting a lot of interventions in the first few hours of life, said Griffin, an obstetrician who voted for the change. Parental rights are violated. Critics of the committee's move argued that the safety of the birth dose is backed by randomized controlled studies and more than three decades of use, with the nation's vaccine safety surveillance systems finding no unusual harms. Panel member Dr. Joseph Heblin, a psychiatrist, voted against the change, saying the committee hadn't reviewed science on why the recommendation should be 2 months. This is unconscionable, he said. No rational science or discussion has been presented. Public health experts have warned against delaying the vaccine or only immunizing the babies of infected women at birth. They note that because the hepatitis B test is typically done in the first trimester, women can still become infected later in pregnancy, or some might not get tested at all. They also say that beyond maternal transmission, the virus is often spread through shared surfaces such as washcloths and toothbrushes. The birth dose is critical to preventing hepatitis B, which is the leading cause of liver cancer worldwide, said Sherry Cohen, president of the Hepatitis B Foundation. It is not a virus you want your baby to have. The committee heard presentations Thursday from ACIP member Vicki Pebsworth, a board member at the National Vaccine Information Center, which advocates against vaccines, CDC contractor Cynthia Nevison, a climate researcher who has worked with the anti-vaccine group Safe Minds and written for Children's Health Defense, the nonprofit founded by Kennedy that has questioned vaccines, and Mark Blacksell, a longtime anti-vaccine activist who now works at the CDC. The newly appointed acting director of the Drugs Division at the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Tracy Beth Haug, suggested to the panel that hepatitis B vaccines shouldn't be given to children at all. She pointed to other countries, including Denmark, that don't recommend the hepatitis B vaccine for all newborns. CDC scientist Adam Langer said many of those other countries, including Denmark, have national health systems in which it is easier to screen and track infected mothers. Blacksell argued that vaccine injury claims paid out by the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program showed the hepatitis B vaccine causes harm, but the federal government has said that such settlements shouldn't be used to draw conclusions about vaccine safety. Dr. Jason Goldman, president of the American College of Physicians, who has been a liaison to ACIP for more than a decade, accused the committee's leadership of promoting an anti-vaccine agenda. Stop cherry-picking data by individuals who do not have the scientific evidence and data-driven background to make those presentations, he said. The panel voted on the hepatitis B recommendation Friday after delaying the vote initially scheduled for Thursday in an effort to give panel members time to consider the exact language on which they were voting. The CDC waited until hours before the meeting began on Thursday to post the vote language, then changed the wording again, causing confusion for panel members and giving outside groups little time to opine on the potential impacts. ACIP's recommendations guide which vaccines are covered at no cost to patients by many insurers and federal health programs. Private insurers in some states may drop coverage for the birth dose for some babies, said vaccine attorney Richard Hughes. A Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services representative said the birth dose would continue to be covered by federal insurance programs. The committee also voted 6-4 with one abstention to recommend that parents consider antibody testing for children after a dose of hepatitis B vaccine to determine whether the child needs further doses, and that insurers cover those tests. Hepatitis B vaccines are typically given as a series of 3 doses. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A few more headlines from the front of the paper here. SpaceX kicked off a secondary share sale that would value the rocket maker at $800 billion to make it the most valuable U.S. private company. Also, the European Union fined Elon Musk's X platform about $140 million for what it sees as breaches of the bloc's landmark digital content law. And the U.S. stocks finished the week near records, lifted by investors' expectations that the Fed will lower interest rates next week. And the copper prices have climbed to a record, driven by fears of a global supply shortage and anticipation of a rate cut. Also, the U.S. regulators rolled back rules that limit how much risk banks can take in corporate lending, strictures that fueled the boom in the private credit industry. And our final headline here is the New York Times sued Perplexity for copyright infringement, expanding its legal fight against artificial intelligence companies that it says steal and then profit from its content. Okay, next we'll read an article. This is the Intelligent Investor column written by Jason Zweig. The title of the article is, Do You Really Know What's Inside Your 401k? Target date funds, the simplest and most popular way to save for retirement, are getting needlessly complicated. Leave it to Wall Street to take a cheap, simple, elegant idea and junk it up with fees, complexity, and opacity. That's what's starting to happen to target date funds, the investment favored by tens of millions of people saving in 401ks and other retirement plans. A vehicle that couldn't be easier to own may soon become too hard to understand. Target date funds are permanent autopilot portfolios that neutralize self-destructive investing behavior. More than two-thirds of all participants in 401k retirement plans hold at least one, according to the Investment Commit Company Institute. When we invest, many of us need to be saved from ourselves. We might chase whatever's hot and dump whatever's not, put too much in our own company stock, or diversify by haphazardly buying a little of this and a lot of that. Saving for a goal that's decades away, we might trade on this week's hopes, fears, headlines, and hunches. There's all-in-one funds solve all that. They hold stocks, bonds, and other assets in predetermined proportions, scaling down risk as investors age. Along the way, if stocks fall too far, too fast, these funds automatically buy. If stocks go up far too fast, these funds mechanically sell. The saying, set it and forget it, was made for these portfolios. It isn't much of an exaggeration to say that with target date funds, the only decision you've had to make is which one to buy in the first place. Clean and simple autopilot portfolios that hold a handful of two of cheap market tracking index funds still dominate the market, but that might not last much longer. Many target date funds are no longer the simple bundles of underlying funds they once were. Nearly 35% hold at least two dozen underlying positions, according to Morningstar data. Crack open an all-in-one portfolio and you're likely to find both a growth and value fund for large stocks, another pair for mid-sized companies, and still another for small stocks. Then there might be stocks screened on their criteria, such as high profitability or minimal price fluctuation, or a couple of strategic or discovery or dynamic funds to make the mix sound more enticing. The same slicing and dicing of international and emerging markets plus a handful of bond funds can easily push a target date portfolio's holdings into the dozens. The resulting jumble, however, is unlikely to outperform a simpler, cheaper autopilot portfolio consisting only of a handful or two of index funds. Another development is more subtle. Over the past decade, as the pressure to cut fees has intensified, employers that sponsor 401k plans have moved away from mutual funds. Instead, they've been selecting collective investment trusts. CITs are pools of assets offered by banks and trust companies, often affiliated with mutual fund managers. CITs are overseen by bank regulators, not by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Unlike mutual funds, they aren't sold directly to the general public, so their lower marketing and regulatory costs typically make them cheaper. So far, so good. The shift to CITs, which have grown to 52% of all target date assets, or nearly $2.1 trillion, has helped drive down costs for retirement savers. However, CITs could end up as a gateway for higher costs, higher risks, and lower visibility. CITs disclose some information about their fees and holdings, but nowhere near what a mutual fund offers, says Janet Yang Rohr, an analyst at Morningstar. For instance, the prospectus of a target date mutual fund must report all of the fees of all its underlying funds. A CIT, though, can invest in funds that don't disclose every layer of fees and their own expense ratios, making it much harder for investors to figure out their true cost. That's music to the ears of firms that manage assets that don't regularly trade in public markets, such as venture capital, private equity, or non-traded real estate, where annual fees can add up to 2 to 8% or more. Private investments make up $115 billion of total target date assets, estimates State Street Investment Management, a small share of this $4 trillion plus market. But the managers of alternative assets have this gigantic market squarely in their sights, especially now that institutional investors are stuffed to the gills with private assets they've been struggling to unload. And target date funds are an almost ideal target market because they're held by investors who are predisposed to not acting, says Morningstar's Yang Rohr. Their assets are unlikely to be withdrawn for decades. What's more, regular payroll deductions pour into target date funds like clockwork, even during market crashes. Every 2 weeks, they get their share, she says. As far as the managers of private assets are concerned, the target in target date funds is you. None of this means you should turn your back on these funds, which can give you a powerful boost toward a sustainable retirement. It does mean you'll need to know what you own and speak up if you don't like it. The ultimate hands-off investment is going to require you to be a lot more hands-on. Another article is the next article, Stocks Rise on Optimism for Rate Cut, written by Vicky G. Hung. Stocks finished the week near records lifted by investors' expectations that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates in the coming weeks. Many investors are betting that falling rates and tax cuts will reinvigorate a sluggish economy and overcome persistent concerns over a weakening labor market and tariff policy uncertainty. That wager powered stocks near records on Friday. The S&P 500 rose 0.2% and the tech-focused NASDAQ gained 0.3%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 104 points or 0.2%. All three indexes posted weekly gains of 0.3% or higher. Interest rate-sensitive stocks, such as those of airlines, truckers, and small-cap companies, gained ground. The Dow Jones Transportation Average, which tracks 20 large U.S. companies, ranging from airlines to railroads to truckers, jumped 3.6% for the week. The Russell 2000 index of small companies logged a weekly gain of 0.8%. The Fed has signaled it is likely to cut short-term rates by a quarter point at its meeting next week. Futures traders have priced in a 87% chance of a rate reduction, according to the CME FedWatch tool. And Wall Street is anticipating more cuts in 2026, with President Trump expected to reveal his choice for a new Fed chair early next year. The Fed is the overarching mood controller of the day, said Mark Malek, Chief Investment Officer at Siebert Financial. That's not going to abate until the FOMC meeting is done and in the can next week. On Friday, investors parsed a slew of economic data ahead of the central bank's meeting. A delayed readout of the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditure Index, showed price pressures increasing slightly in September. The PCE rose by 0.3% month over month and 2.8% from a year earlier, in line with consensus expectations. Consumer sentiment rose for the first time in 5 months, thanks in part to the improvement in inflation expectations. The University of Michigan's gauge of consumer sentiment rose to 53.3 in December from 51 in November. Fed officials will have another chance to assess the labor market using data from Tuesday Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey before announcing their interest rate decision. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note ended the week at 4.138% after logging its biggest one-week gain since April. Bond yields and prices move inversely. Bitcoin fell $90,000 after a rebound earlier in the week. The cryptocurrency is 29% below an early October peak above $126,000. While markets saw tepid movements this week, some investors are looking past the near-term inertia, viewing the prospect of lower rates, the impact of President Trump's tax cuts, and the boom in artificial intelligence as catalysts that could fuel significant market gains next year. We are in a time period of seasonal strength, and we continue to see AI infrastructure as a driver going forward, said Rick Gardner, Chief Investment Officer at RGA Investments. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next article is entitled Times Sues Perplexity Over Content for AI. Article is written by Alexandra Bruhl. The New York Times is suing generative AI startup Perplexity for copyright infringement, expanding its legal fight against artificial intelligence companies that it says steal and then profit off its content. The Times accuses Perplexity of illegally crawling its material and repackaging original Times stories in verbatim or near verbatim written responses to users. It also accused the company of copyright infringements for its videos, podcasts, and images, and of fabricating information and falsely attributing it to the Times. The Times also said Perplexity's Comet AI assistant, which can browse the web and complete tasks for users, produced detailed summaries of Times articles. Perplexity has violated the protections that intellectual property law provides for the Times' expressive original journalism, the Times said in its suit, which was filed in New York federal court. The publisher is seeking damages and injunction of relief, including removal of Times content from Perplexity's products. Publishers have been suing new tech companies for 100 years, starting with radio, TV, the internet, social media, and now AI, said Perplexity spokesperson Jesse Doyer. Unfortunately, it's never worked, or we'd all be talking about this by telegraph. Relations between the New York Times and Perplexity have been strained for more than a year. The Times issued a notice to Perplexity in October 2024 demanding that it stop accessing and using the media outlet's content, the Wall Street Journal reported at the time. The Times sent another notice this past July, but Perplexity has continued to access and use its content, according to the suit. We are very much interested in working with every single publisher, Perplexity Chief Executive Aravind Srivanus said in response to last year's cease and desist notice. We have no interest in being anyone's antagonist here. Publishers have taken a mixed approach to AI companies, forging partnerships and content licensing deals with some, while also pursuing litigation against others in an effort to receive financial compensation for the use of their content. Wall Street Journal publisher Dow Jones and the New York Post are suing Perplexity for copyright infringement. Our next article, titled Exits Signal Risks for iPhone, is written by Rolf Winkler. Apple is facing a wave of executive departures as the company continues a period of transition, not only among its leadership, but if rivals have their way, for its business too. On Thursday, Apple announced that its general counsel and head of policy will both retire next year. On Wednesday, a top designer left for Meta Platforms. On Monday, Apple said its head of artificial intelligence strategy would retire. Its chief operating officer announced his retirement in July, and its chief financial officer has moved to a new role. There is a changing of the guard underway at Apple, even as Chief Executive Officer Tim Cook himself shows no sign of stepping down. Cook and his new lieutenants face a critical test preparing Apple for the AI era and the wave of new competitive devices that result. Further down the organizational chart, dozens of Apple employees have defected to OpenAI and Meta in recent months, part of a long-term brain drain that has robbed the company of innovators and seeded rivals with expertise they hope to use to dethrone the digital device king. Apple's reign will continue as long as consumers access their online services and its device, and that dominion over the means of app distribution rankles other tech heavyweights who are trying to find ways to control their own destinies, including Mark Zuckerberg, Sam Altman, and Elon Musk. Zuckerberg this past week hired Apple's Alan Dye, a top Apple designer, after hiring away a handful of Apple's key AI staffers. Altman paid $6.5 billion to acquihire Steve Jobs' protege, Joni Ive, who helped build the iPhone and the Apple Watch, along with Ive's team that comes with other ex-Apple stars. They are planning an AI device that they hope will be the future of computing. The new hardware arm of OpenAI has been hiring aggressively from the iPhone maker recently as well. Dozens of Apple engineers and designers with expertise in audio, watch design, robotics, and more have decamped to OpenAI in recent months, according to a review of LinkedIn profiles. Musk has at times considered building a smartphone himself, owing to frustration with Apple's dominance, the Wall Street Journal has reported. His social media platform X is suing Apple because he is unhappy about the placement of his own AI app in the App Store. None is an immediate threat. Consumers' lives are on their iPhones. There isn't yet a killer AI app that would make them more than digital selves, much less a device that offers it. Yet, without a coherent AI strategy of its own, one that can convince customers and employees that the company can play a meaningful role developing the defining technology of the decade, Apple is leaving an opening for rivals. One executive still firmly encamped at Apple is Cook. Despite turning 65 last month, an age at which many CEOs are contemplating retirement, Cook hasn't slowed down. He has demonstrated his value to shareholders again this year by deftly handling President Trump, beating back the threat of tariffs, and returning Apple's stock to record territory. If he can deliver successful AI products before he departs, Cook can secure his legacy while giving his successor a running start. News Corp, owner of the Journal, has a commercial agreement to supply news through Apple services. It has a content licensing partnership with OpenAI. Okay, our last article for the day is about Southwest Airlines. Southwest said Friday demand temporarily sputtered during the government shutdown. Southwest Airlines cut its profit guidance for the year, citing rising fuel costs and lost revenue from this fall's U.S. government shutdown. The carrier said Friday that the demand temporarily sputtered during the 43-day shutdown, which included 10 days of government-ordered flight restrictions at 40 major airports. Southwest now expects earnings before interest and taxes to come in at $500 billion for 2025, down from a prior projection for $600 million to $800 million. Bookings have since bounced back to the company's previous expectations, Southwest said. Shares ticked down 2% to $37.83 on Friday. The Federal Aviation Administration ordered a reduction in air traffic earlier last month in response to staffing shortages among federal transportation workers who went weeks without pay while the government shut down. Delta Airlines disclosed Wednesday that its bookings fell 5% to 10% during the 10 days that flights were restricted. The airline said the shutdown dented its fourth quarter profit by about $200 million or 25 cents a share. Alaska Air Group, which owns Alaska Airlines and Hawaiian Airlines, forecasts that the shutdown's disruption and related revenue losses will eat into its fourth quarter adjusted earnings by 15 cents a share. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 6th and 7th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition. Your reader has been Dave Payne. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, books, and other printed matter to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service has broadcast almost 40 years of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call 716-821-5555. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another